I'd like to continue with what I started the last class that I gave, which was 2 weeks ago. Now, I mentioned that the most crucial moment in Jewish history, in Torah history, really was, to my mind, was that the chapter in Exodus, which deals with the instruction given to the children of Israel pertaining to the Paschal Lamb and all the commandments that they received that night. And that is because that was the transition of the people of Israel from idolatrous people to people of the Torah. And therefore, one would expect that in that chapter, you would find the most basic principles of Torah. And it is so. The most basic principles of Torah, the fundamentals in terms of philosophy and the entire outlook, is really in that chapter. It's the first time that Moses really taught the people, was acting in the capacity and the role of a Rebbe, a teacher to the people. And the Torah is really something that one must look into before one can really understand it. People who do not have access to the in-depth approach of Torah, that is, people who do not understand the oral law, are not learned in the oral law, really have always walked away with a shallow concept of what the Torah is all about. I mean, people, the Torah never works out according to the way one would think intuitively. Okay, I mean by intuitively, I mean on a simplistic, intuitive level, where your thoughts are derived from the way people in general act. The historical approach, in other words. The Torah is not a story of the chosen people going to the Promised Land. That's not what the story is about. As a matter of fact, in the five books of Moses, they never get to the Promised Land. The Torah is the story of a transition of a people. People who made a complete change from an ordinary way of life, which contained idolatry, to a very unique kind of life. That's why things don't work out the way an historian would imagine. An historian would imagine that the people should go out of Egypt to the Promised Land and then start building the tabernacle. No, the tabernacle is built in the desert. The Torah is received not in Israel, but it's received in the desert. Okay? The first teaching of Torah takes place, of all places, in the land of Egypt. Okay? And that is because the Torah is not a superficial kind of a system. It's God's system, and the reasons for the way things are in the Torah require a depth of understanding, and not you cannot apply the common sense. The common sense approach to Torah never works. People have always tried to do that because there are people that spend their lives trying to explain away the Torah, but they always try to use a common sense approach to the verses in the Torah. It does not work. Never pans out. So what they finally wind up doing is, reading certain verses and then applying their not being consistent with the rest of the verses in the Torah. So here in Egypt we find the learning of Torah begins for the first time, and that's in Exodus in chapter 12. Okay, now, the medium of making this transition from the primitive lifestyle of Egypt to the very sophisticated lifestyle of Torah took place through several commandments. And I just want to, I may have mentioned this before, but I want everyone to make sure that they understand that there that the commandments were given in according to the principles of halacha, and there was no magical protection that took place here. For instance, if you look at chapter 12, verse 13, it says, "The blood shall be unto you for a sign on the houses which you are there." And the oral law explains that word "unto you" for a sign is not extra, but it should have just said the blood should be a sign on the houses. No, it's unto you. So the blood was placed on the inside of the door, and not on the outside. Because on the outside, one would think it's like kind of like a magic type of thing. On the inside, it's not visible, because God doesn't have to pass by and see the blood. So it had to be placed on the inside. And then where it says God says he will see the blood, this does not mean that God is passing by and looks at the blood. The blood is on the inside. Everything God sees all, but it means to say that the God will take note of the fact that you are doing the commandments, his commandments, and this is what will be the salvation, cause the salvation of the people. Not not any kind of magical instrument or any kind of, it's not the blood itself. It is the fact that the people of Israel kept the commandment of slaughtering the Paschal Lamb, which required tremendous courage because the Lamb was the God of the Egyptians. And therefore, the fact that they were able to slaughter the Lamb and use the blood of the Lamb for a mitzvah, for a commandment, required tremendous courage on their part, and because they kept the commandments, that's why they received salvation. Now, that's just I just wanted to, by way of introduction, to explain what the verses mean. But now, when we take a look at the, let's get into more of the details, because it says when God says he will see the blood, it means keeping the commandments. The blood was one commandment, but of course it means keeping all the commandments that were given in the very chapter where this is stated. Now, as I said, these commandments, and the question, somebody may ask the question, say, well, why am I teaching this to Bnei Noach? After all, we know that Bnei Noach are not supposed to be studying other commandments other than the seven laws of Noah. And first of all, the reason is because they must know thoroughly, the Bnei Noach must know thoroughly the seven commandments. And those take enormous amount of time. A person really will never get finished with them, even in one lifetime. They're infinitely deep, just like the rest of Torah. So the Bnei Noach is supposed to be preoccupied primarily with his commandments. So why am I teaching these commandments, which have little or nothing to do with the Bnei Noach? We'll see actually that it does have something to do. It does cross these commandments actually do cut across the Bnei Noach, do involve the Bnei Noach at one point, but there is the major reason why that wouldn't justify teaching all the details that I'm going to teach about these commandments. But the major reason why I'm teaching this is because, if a Bnei Noach wants to do a commandment, he is entitled to do that, and then he's entitled to study that commandment. Because otherwise, the Torah is only permitted to be studied by the Ben Israel. Because the Torah cannot be just idle speculation. It has to be something which is meaningful. So if the Bnei Noach wants to do a commandment, then he can study that particular commandment. But aside from that, more basic is the fact that a Bnei Noach must really have a very good overall picture of what Torah is. And therefore, while the Bnei Noach should not be spending their time in the details of the commandments, the overall picture of what commandments are and the most basic concept of halacha, what halacha is, should be known to the Bnei Noach, because that's part of the very religious structure of the Ben Noach mind. In other words, the mind of the Ben Noach has to know exactly what is the nature of Torah in general. So therefore, it is permissible to be involved, engaged in this area on the level that we will be discussing, which is a basic level, so that the Ben Noach should know, should have an understanding of what the Torah is like, what commandments are like, and how Moses really taught the people and changed their whole philosophy from the primitive to the philosophy of Torah. So this is a basic concept in the whole philosophy of Torah, which the Ben Noach should really and must have. For instance, the concept of sacrifices. Many people think sacrifices are primitive. And why are we asking God to bring back the third temple to have these sacrifices, if sacrifices are primitive? The only way we can answer that question is the only people that think that the Torah sacrifices are primitive are people who have never studied halacha. So they associate the sacrifices of primitive tribes with the Torah sacrifices. But once one studies halacha, one sees that the sacrifices in the temple were of the most sophisticated type of human performance possible. And every step involves great depth of knowledge and great thought and theoretical understanding and practical application to the nth degree. And the sacrifice, when you understand the concept of sacrifice, it has the beauty of a mathematical formula. It's a completely intellectual performance. Of course, in order to see that, one must study halacha. One must understand halacha. Now, that's another reason why I feel I want to just demonstrate to you some of the basic concepts over here, so you'll get an idea as to what exactly the Paschal Lamb involved, the ideas and the concepts that it involved. Now, I know many people feel that, you know, that they've had the basics already, and that's why what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask some questions as we go along. So this way it'll be like you'll be able to sort of test yourself and see if you in fact understand it. All right? Now, last time we mentioned that, of course, the most basic breakdown when it comes to commandments is the positive and negative commandments, okay? And, of course, over here in this chapter 12 in Exodus, you have that basic breakdown. But now, what we're going to do is go a little bit beyond that basic breakdown, okay? And we're going to discuss, and I started to discuss this last time, I believe, two types of positive commandments. One type of positive commandment is, for instance, let's take the commandment of putting off phylacteries. Simple to understand, okay? Put off phylacteries. That's a positive commandment. There's another positive commandment where it states, when it states the animals that one is not permitted to eat, so there it states that, hold on a second. So there it states that, these animals you shall eat. And that is also a positive commandment. You shall eat these animals. All right. Now, there is a difference between these two positive commandments. Can anyone explain what the difference is between these two commandments? One commandment says, they're both positive, both count as positive commandments. One states, you shall eat this, these are the animals you shall eat. That's positive. Another one states, put on phylacteries. Let's take that as an example. Now, we have to understand, what is the difference between these two types? These are two types that we're discussing now. Can anyone explain the difference? You don't have to answer me. I'm asking this question. If you want to, you can.
Miss Lisa Blackburn has the answer.
Go ahead.
All right, come here and talk.
They're both commandments, but one you don't have to do. The part about eating the meat, or eating the types of animals.
One, you don't have to do.
But the laying of the phylactery, you
that
do have to.
That is eating the animals.
That's correct.
And putting on the phylacteries, you have to do.
That's correct.
That is halfway correct. Okay? Actually, you're saying that they're both similar, but one is optional and one is mandatory. Okay? That's not precisely true. Because the commandments in the Torah, the positive commandments, are all of a mandatory nature. All right? I mean, I'm speaking generally, but for general purposes, they're all of a mandatory nature. They're not optional. Okay? Anyone want to take it further?
All right. To amplify what Lisa said, that you're not commanded to eat meat, you're permitted to eat it, aren't you?
Yes.
But you are commanded to lay phylactery, tefillin.
Yes,
so the eating you shall eat, if you desire to eat meat, you can, but it's not optional on laying tefillin. So that
yes,
would be...
you're saying the same thing she's saying.
That's right.
But that the problem with that is that the 613 commandments, every positive commandment is not mandatory. God does not say, if you want to eat, you can eat. He doesn't have to say that.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a commandment. A commandment means an injunction.
And the second aspect that Lisa says, that the women are not commanded to lay tefillin, but they are permitted to eat the meat.
But we're getting away from the original point.
All right. We'll quit grappling then.
Okay. Let me just explain this. Okay. The positive commandments are not optional; they're mandatory. So you cannot say that the eating of the meat, when the Torah says you shall eat this meat, that it's optional. That's not a commandment. If it's optional, it's not a commandment. Okay? All right? So the question, return to the question. Now, this is important. Important is you have to have when studying the Torah, you have to have very precise definitions, and precision is very important. You know, a lot of times I see people say, especially, you know, when you're giving a class to students, students say, you know, oh, yeah, well, I know that. I knew that. And whenever I see that, I say, okay. And the next question I ask, I say, okay, now you say it. And usually you find that that they don't say it precisely. But a lot of times people are vague in their minds and they think they know it, but then when you ask them to really state it precisely, they don't have it precisely. Now here, precision is extremely important. Now I want to tell you, let me explain what the difference is. They're both mandatory, okay? But one is a positive, which means you should do something, and the other one is a positive, which means you shall not do something. Okay? In other words, when the Torah says put on tefillin, that's a positive, which you should do something. You should put on the phylacteries. All right? It's true. It's only for men, not for women. That's another difference, but I'm not talking about that. Now with the meat, when God says, this animal you shall eat, what it means is only these animals you shall eat. This is the animal that you shall eat, means eat only these animals. So it means to say, if you eat anything other, you're in violation. It would be like a person saying, eat only this bread, which means if you eat something else, you're in violation. Okay? So there's a positive commandment which teaches you to do something. There's a positive commandment which teaches you not to do something. Okay? So it's not optional. It's mandatory. You are not permitted to eat anything other than these animals. Okay, they're both mandatory, but one of them is a prohibition, and one of them is a positive commandment, okay? Now, this sounds very simple, and in a way it is, but you have to understand that this itself presents certain questions. I'll give you an example. In Deuteronomy it says that if a person is walking on the road and he sees a nest with a bird, and the bird is the mother bird is roosting on the eggs or on the chicks, and the Torah tells you that what you should do is you should not take the mother and the eggs, okay? But rather it says, send away the mother, and you can take the eggs or the chicks, okay? Now, what kind of a commandment is this? Here we have the question. The Torah says, send away the mother, okay? Does that mean to say that if I'm walking along the road and I happen to see this nest with the bird and the eggs, that I have to actually go up there and send away the mother or not? Okay? In other words, the question is what we mentioned before. What kind of a commandment is this? Is it a prohibition, which means to say that if I go up on the tree and I take the nest, I'm not permitted to take the mother and the babies, the mother and the eggs. Then I have to send away the mother, and if I don't do that, I'm in violation. But if I'm walking by and I see that, I don't have to actually go up there and send away the mother. Okay? That's the question. What kind of a commandment? Is it a positive commandment, or is it a stated in the positive, but really it's prohibitive? In other words, you're not permitted to... First of all, the Torah says, do not... By the way, many times you have a negative and positive for the same thing. That's for emphasis, which means to say that sometimes with one action, you will violate a negative commandment and also a positive commandment. For instance, eating the non-kosher food. That's both negative and positive. First of all, God said, don't eat. If a person should eat a camel, if a Jew should eat a camel, so then he would be in violation of the negative, do not eat the camel. Also, he will be in violation of eat only these kosher animals. So many times in Torah, you have the negative and the positive for the same exact action. And the reason for that is that for emphasis, that the Torah, when it comes to violations that are important, they're often expressed in both forms, negative and positive. Now over here, with the case of the bird, that's the question we're raising. Is this a case of negative and positive? Which means to say, if I don't send away the mother, so there's two violations. First of all, the Torah says, do not take the mother and the babies. I'll be violating that negative commandment. Okay? And secondly, I'll be violating the positive commandment, because the positive commandment says, when you go to take them, send away the mother. And here, I failed to send away the mother. So I am again in violation, because I did not do that action. When I took the nest, I didn't do the action of sending away the mother. So therefore, I'm in violation again of a positive commandment. Now, if that's the case, then, of course, the commandment of sending away the mother is nothing more than another form of a prohibition, just like the commandment of eat these animals, which means restrict your diet to these animals, not to include the others. Okay? If, however, sending away the mother, the concept of sending away the mother is like tefillin, like putting on phylacteries, then that means if I'm walking in the woods and I see the nest and the mother, and the mother's roosting on the eggs, I have to actually go to the nest and send away the mother. Okay? This happened to be a question that was asked to a later day halachist, okay, a later day scholar. As a matter of fact, this scholar concluded, I don't agree with this, but this scholar concluded that it actually is a positive command, which means to say that you have to climb the tree and go and send away the mother. In my opinion, it's a negative commandment, okay? In other words, I do not have to go up that tree and send the mother away. It's only negative. In other words, it means to say, if I take the nest and fail to send away the mother, then I'm in violation of a positive commandment. I fail to send away the mother. But there's no obligation upon me to actually go up there and send away the mother. I could refrain from doing anything. Okay? Do you understand? It's not like tefillin where I have to do something. It is like the case with regard to the kosher animals. I don't have to eat any animals, but if I do, I must eat only these, not those. So positive sometimes can be positive in truth. Sometimes it can be actually a negative. Now, of course, the question is, why do I maintain that you do not have to go up, climb the tree, and send the wave? How do I know? It's a good question. And the Torah expresses itself many times in a positive form, which can be interpreted two ways. Either you can say it means you must do it, or else it means to say, no, you should do only this and not only X and not Y. Okay, do you follow? Now, how do we determine this? We must have a method of making a determination. Okay? What is the solution to how we determine this? Okay. The answer is, the way this is determined is very simple. All right? We look at the commandment, and we study it. And, of course, we consult the oral law, because without the oral law, you can't study anything. And we determine whether there is a positive fulfillment involved in this performance or not. Okay? What it means is like this. When I study the commandment, I should be able to determine whether there is a positive objective in the commandment or there isn't a positive objective in the commandment. All right? Now, let's take the case of tefillin. When I study tefillin, and if you understand tefillin properly, it becomes pretty obvious that there is a positive gain in putting on tefillin. Putting on tefillin has a positive objective. Okay, the objective is remembrance of Egypt, going out of Egypt. It has the major concepts of Torah as written on the scrolls inside the tefillin. Reminds one of the main concepts of Torah, the oneness of God, the study of Torah, the love of God. Okay. So obviously, when one studies the commandment of the phylacteries, one knows that immediately that this is something positive that God is commanding. So if it's something positive, so then I cannot interpret it in a negative way. I must interpret it in a positive way, which means I must say it doesn't mean put only phylacteries on your arm and nothing else. It means, no, put phylacteries on your arm. That is the objective. Now, let's take the case with the animals, okay? Now, over there, the Torah says, eat these animals. Now, the question is the Torah aiming at any positive gain by eating these animals? Think about it logically. Is there a positive gain in eating the animals? Is there if a person eats an animal, is he a superior person in any way? Is this some kind of a fulfillment according to Torah? Well, anyone that knows the philosophy of the Torah or has studied the 613 commandments would know that there is no such thing, of course. There is no benefit. A person who eats a piece of meat a day, is a pound of meat a day, is not superior to a person that doesn't, nor is there any benefit in eating meat at any time, basically. So there, it's pretty clear and pretty obvious from the oral law that there is nothing positive involved when the Torah says eat these animals. So therefore I know there's nothing positive, so I know that this must be a removal, okay, which means a restriction. Eat these, not those, okay? So it's a prohibition stated in positive terms. Now I ask you, now that we have this reasoning, okay, and we can decipher and determine which commandment is which, although I assure you there are some that are not that simple, let's take the case of the bird in the nest, okay? What would you say over there? Is that a positive idea, or is it not positive? It's simply the avoidance of doing something else. You're not supposed to do something else. Okay. Now, by a show of hands, tell me how many think sending away the mother when you happen upon this nest and the mother's lying on the egg, sending away the mother is a positive objective or gain. Is some positive gain or objective involved? How many think that way? Raise your hands. And how many think there is no positive gain? Raise your hands. I'm just curious. What is the consensus of opinion here? Just tell me which way it went.
3-1 in for the first, that there's a positive gain by sending her away.
And how many said no?
No, 3-1 yes.
Oh, the ratio is 3-1 that there is a positive gain.
Yes.
Okay. I may be outnumbered here, but to my mind, there is nothing positive about it. In other words, there is no positive gain in sending away a mother bird that is on her nest. I'd like to know what positive thing am I accomplishing by sending away the mother. The Torah obviously, and by the way, the halacha is that you're not permitted. When is the prohibition? The prohibition is if the mother's on the nest, or as long as the mother is basically attached to the nest. Because, in other words, the mother is sticking by the nest because of her offspring.
Rabbi, yeah. Would it not be the same principle of not boiling the kid in the milk of its mother?
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. The concept over there, there are many concepts involved, many benefits involved, but the main idea over here is that I'm giving you two interpretations. One interpretation, of course, is that the mother, this is Maimonides' interpretation, is that the mother, God wants man to be compassionate, and therefore, when the mother is hovering over the nest, the mother's over the chicks or the eggs, to take the mother together with the nest, to rob them both together it will be too painful for the mother. And as a matter of fact, Maimonides states that therefore the Torah says chase away the mother, but he says moreover the eggs usually are worthless because they're probably usually fertilized and they can't be eaten. So most people will simply not do, will simply let the whole thing go. Won't even approach the nest. In other words, the Torah did not want the bird in its vulnerable state to be able to be attacked by man, because the mother is very vulnerable at that time, and to attack the mother when it's vulnerable, it's hanging around the nest because it has an attachment to its offspring. So to attack it as that vulnerable, in that vulnerable state, is not expressive of a compassionate person. And also, it teaches man that man should not destroy a species. And the species are usually destroyed when their instincts work against them in terms of vulnerability, because that's when they are most capable of being destroyed. When their instincts, the breeding season renders most of the animals very very vulnerable, because they have to leave their natural habitat, whether it's the air, they have to rest in a certain place, and they can't be just flying around with birds or with other animals. I'm sure you're familiar with it. So there are two things here. One is compassion, that man should be compassionate and not attack an animal in its vulnerable state. And two, there is the concept of that the species should be preserved as well. One of the authorities gives that interpretation, which makes sense. But the concept rings loud and clear that there is no benefit in chasing away a mother bird from a nest. I mean, what possible benefit could there be in doing something like that? You know, is that an accomplishment, to go up there in the tree, to climb the tree, and to chase the mother away? What positive gain would there be in that? Why not leave the mother and then the eggs alone? I mean, what gain would there be in chasing away the mother? You see, I don't see any positive gain in such an action. Therefore, I agree with those authorities, and among them is Maimonides, because it's interesting. Usually, it's very hard to go from Maimonides' book on the reasons for commandments to have a cross-reference from there to his halacha, because halacha is the logical structure, sort of like the science of the system, whereas the guide for the perplexed is really the philosophy. Usually the two are unrelated. Well, you can't bring proof from one system to the other. But over here you can, because Maimonides, in giving his reasons, states that God didn't want man to perform an act which lacks compassion, that is to take the mother with the babies. The mother sees the babies being taken, and this is, and she is there as well. This is horrible for her. It's better to chase her away. She'll forget about it soon, and she'll start another nest. But moreover, Maimonides says, in most cases, this very commandment will prevent man from even tampering with the nest in general, which is even better. So he says the purpose of the commandment really is not just in the specifics, but even better, the purpose of the commandment is expressed even more when man decides, because of the commandment, he says, look, I'm just going to get stuck with these eggs, and they're really not worth much, or the baby chicks, and it's not really worth much, so therefore I might as well forget the whole thing, because most people are really after the mother, whether it's, whether it's a squab, a goose, whatever it might be. Most people are after the big bird, not the baby. So therefore, they will forego the entire situation. They won't take it at all. So therefore, you see from Maimonides, since he says the purpose of the commandment is to make man, it's even better that the man just leave it alone. So you see, obviously, he maintains there is nothing positive involved in this commandment. And even though it's a positive action of sending away the mother, but really you do not have to do that, and it's best really to leave it alone and not really to bother at all. It's not like putting off phylacteries where you are supposed to do something because there's a positive gain. Over here it's simply a negative.
Rabbi,
okay, yes.
Can I give a couple of points from another perspective?
You certainly can.
Okay, first of all, I would say if an individual was going to eat eggs, that he should be in tune with the environment in which the eggs are produced. Many of us, being from the country, know that you can eat fertilized eggs. Because
that they're starting to grow already.
All right, well, see, that's the second point I'm going to make. That if you are on the farm and you understand the productive cycle, you know when to gather eggs and when not to gather eggs. So if you are gathering the eggs from this goose or guinea or any other egg that is edible, you wouldn't go out and eat robin's eggs or bluebird eggs or something like that. You are familiar with the reproductive cycle. You're familiar with the laying cycle. So therefore, if you're going to take the eggs, the positive commandment would be to shoo the mother away in order to take the eggs, and she's going to come back and lay others. But you have to know the cycle, and that is in with the Rambam. You do have to know the cycle. You know the purpose behind it. Therefore, you would not, if you are in tune with the environment, you're not going to go out and actually gather all the eggs and then kill the mother also, because you want to have a perpetual supply of eggs and fowl.
I understand that, but my question still is, if I see the fowl and I see the mother and the eggs, do I have to do this? If you tell me it's a positive commandment, I must shoo away the mother and take those eggs.
Well, I would say you have to if... Now, see, this is the conditional. It's conditional like eating meat. If I'm going to eat meat, I have to eat only clean.
Ah, then you're saying it's not like phylacteries. It's like, and that's why it's of the two, which one is it like? Is it like the meat or is it like the phylacteries?
It would be with the meat.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, all right.
Okay, good. Okay, finally...
Okay.
You agree with me.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
But I'm saying that it's not so simple... Unless you are in, in Far Rockaway, I don't think y'all go out and gather eggs. You go down to the little store and get them by the dozen in the carton.
Yeah, but you have to understand, this commandment is only it's not if you're raising it. If you're raising the chickens, you're allowed to eat the eggs.
Right.
And you don't have to shoo away the mother. It's only if you happen upon this in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not speaking, the Torah makes it clear that it's speaking in the wild situation, not in the domestic situation.
Okay.
In the domestic situation, you're right. And as a matter of fact, I spent the summer on an egg farm, so I'm not totally ignorant about these things.
Okay.
But
I didn't insinuate that. I did not insinuate that at all. Okay, so we're in agreement, just a little different on the approach.
That's right. We're just a little different on the description.
Okay.
Okay. You know, see, what my mind says is that in the wild, most of the time, the eggs are not going to be edible. Why? Because the cycle of eggs is a long one. It takes, as a matter of fact, I raise canaries. I believe it takes 14 days for the eggs to hatch. Now, during the 14 days, there's a very, in other words, of the time that you actually have an egg, most of the time it's not edible. In other words, it's only edible in the early period when it's first laid. But then you have it start, as soon as it starts growing, it's not edible anymore. So most of the time that it is an egg, it is not edible. So therefore, Maimonides states that the purpose of the Torah is really to leave it alone. Leave it alone, which means it is not like phylacteries. It is, as David said, it is just like the case of the meat, okay? So there again, you have the method of distinguishing between these two commandments. Now, when the Torah says, for instance, let's get back to the case that we're discussing now. Let's say the Torah says we have the commandment of eating meat, which we said is merely a negation, a negative. What about the commandment of eating the paschal lamb? Is that a positive like tefillin, or is it a negative like eating meat? Which one do you think it is? Just those who think it's like the phylacteries, raise your hands. And which one? And the ones that think that it's like the eating the meat, raise your hands. Which one? What's the consensus here now? Well,
we went 5-0 with the first.
Okay. It's like the phylacteries.
Right.
Okay, that's correct.
Okay.
Okay.
Are we doing okay?
Yeah, that's
are correct. We going to get a star on this trip?
On that one, you get a star.
All right. All right. We want a star in the candy bar on this because we're not going to eat those eggs.
Okay. Now let us go a little further. This is We just got off to a start, but let's go a little further now. Now, there you have the two types of positive commandments. Now, now we're going to distinguish again another distinction between two types of positive commandments. All right, and this is a little bit more subtle. You have a commandment. Let's take the night of Passover. You have a commandment to eat the matzah. And I think most of you are familiar with these commandments. And then you have a commandment to eat the Paschal lamb when the Holy Temple was in existence. All right? Now, the commandment to eat the matzah is obviously a true positive. All right? It's not it's not one that's negative. It's a true positive, like phylacteries, okay? Then again, the eating of the Paschal lamb, everybody agrees, is also a true positive. Now, however, can we distinguish between these two types of positives, or are they identical? All right? Now, let me just, I will quote, and I don't have Maimonides in front of me, I'll just paraphrase, but I'll paraphrase what Maimonides says with regard to the way Maimonides formulates these two commandments. Maimonides' words are very precise when he formulates the commandment. You could derive concepts just from watching carefully the words that he uses, the language, the semantics. Now, with regard to the matzah, he states as follows, that when a person must eat matzah on the night of Passover, and then he says what the amount is. The amount is the size of an olive, okay? Most of the eating in the Torah is always the size of an olive, because there has to be a size. You can't just say, eat matzah, how much? You know, I mean, you have to have halacha demands precision. How much? God says to eat matzah, how much matzah? Okay, so it's the size of an olive. Now, eating of the Paschal lamb. Each person also had to eat a part of the Paschal lamb. Now, how much do you have to eat there? Also, the size of an olive. All right? And every time there's a mitzvah to eat, it's always the size of an olive. But now there's a distinction between these two. When Maimonides writes about eating the matzah, so he says, and the moment the person ate the size of an olive of matzah, the quantity of an olive of matzah, okay, which is about, let's say, an ounce. So the moment, an ounce, I mean in terms of volume, not okay, volume of an ounce. So the moment a person ate the olive size of matzah, he says he fulfilled the commandment. Now, with regard to the paschal lamb, he words it a little differently. He says, and if the person only ate the size of an olive, he fulfilled the commandment. All right? In the first case, he says, the moment the person ate the olive size of matzah, he fulfilled the commandment. In the second case, he says, and if he only ate that amount, he fulfilled the commandment. Now, what is the implication, and why the change in language? All right? Let's just take the direct implication. When Maimonides states about the matzah, and the moment the person ate the size of an olive, he fulfilled the commandment, all right, that implies that anything beyond that is simply worthless. Correct? Agreed? In the case of the paschal lamb, when he says, and if he only ate the size of an olive, he fulfilled the commandment, the implication is the more the better. If he eats more, it's even better. Okay? Now, we understand the one by matzah. That makes perfect sense. If God says to do such and such, and you know exactly what he commanded. He said, eat the matzah, all right? So the moment you ate the matzah, you fulfill the obligation. Now, beyond the obligation, there is no benefit, because God didn't tell you to do that. So we leave it to God. He says, eat an olive size, that's it. More than that, you can eat it, eat as much matzah as you want. But is there any halachic value? Is this considered a mitzvah? Is this considered a halachic performance, a commandment? The answer, obviously, is no, because all God said was this one olive size is the commandment. That's the extent of it. Now, by the paschal lamb, we have the same thing. God said again, eat the size of an olive with regard to the paschal lamb. Why, then, does Maimonides say, but if he eats more, or he implies, at least, that if you eat more, it's even better? How, you can't be better than what God tells you to do. There's no such thing. We know that that borders on idolatry when a person tries to be better or different than what the Torah tells him to do. So why is it over here Maimonides states that if you eat more than an olive, you eat two olives, it's even better? Okay? How could that be? How could it be better than God's law? It can't be better than God's law. God's law is the best, the ultimate. It cannot be better. All right? What is the answer to this question? This is an important question. And it's a concept that was received again on in Egypt with regard to eating the paschal lamb. Okay? So it's, again, a basic. All right. Now, this one, I'm going to try to follow along a little bit with this. There is another law with regard to the paschal lamb, if you remember, and that is one is not permitted to leave it over till the morning. All right? In other words, the paschal lamb had to be consumed that night. And if you remember, the first thing that the Bible says in Exodus 12 is that you shall take a, to verse 3, 12, 3, you should take a lamb. It says one lamb for a household, one lamb for a house. And then we'll soon see why it says a household and a house. Because a household is bigger than the house. All right? So take a look at verse 4. It says, and if the house is too small for one lamb, then he and his neighbor who is close to him shall take for his house. And then it says in Hebrew, it's b'michsas nefashos, which means, in English, it means according to the number of souls of people, each person, each man, according to his eating, shall you calculate or appoint on the lamb. Okay? So now we have this calculation business. And it's right at the very beginning of the chapter. Now, what is this calculation, and what is this household and house and calculating, and if it's too small, then you join with your neighbor? What is the Torah saying over here? This was a command. commandments, after all, given to the people, have to understand what is all this complication. Why don't you say, well, eat the lamb and that's it? I mean, you know, there's the, what does all this do in this precision and all these terms and requirements, all right? Here, you know, people who deny halacha, deny the oral law, they just don't learn the written law well. That's basically what it is, because the oral law is nothing more than an exact explanation of every word in the Torah, because the oral law maintains that God does not give extra words. And those who deny the oral law, really, they just deny the written law, really. They deny that. They just say, well, these verses, just, you know, just read them casually, and there's a lot of words here that you don't need. But the oral law says that every word counts. Now, what is God saying in these two verses? Okay? Now, the answer is as follows. There are two types of commandments. You see, there's a commandment where I have to do an action. All right? Let's go back to the phylacteries. I have to put on phylacteries. Or I have to take, let's take a different one. I have to take a lulav. I have to take the four species on Sukkot. All right? That's one kind of commandment. But sometimes that's a commandment on the part of the person. Okay, the person. But now, there is a commandment in terms of the object. All right? And this comes into the picture, essentially, when you're dealing with sacrifices. This is a very big principle in the area of sacrifices. In the area of sacrifices, there is the major part of the area, as a matter of fact, is not so much what you have to do, but what must be done to the animal. In other words, the animal, the sacrifice, has an objective, as an object. It must, certain things must be done to it. Now, what the Torah is describing here is as follows, that the Paschal lamb is an object which has a certain objective. What is the objective of the Paschal lamb? The objective of the Paschal lamb is that it must find its ultimate state must be in consumption, human consumption. In other words, it's not just a commandment to eat the Paschal lamb. That would be a commandment of the person. But it's a commandment regarding the object, which means the object of the Paschal lamb must be consumed. Okay? That's why you have all these laws. For instance, you cannot leave it over till the next day, which means if you leave it over till the next day, it's only allowed to be eaten at night. So if you leave it over till the next day, that means the Paschal lamb did not find its ultimate objective, which is human consumption. It must be consumed by the person. That's why the Torah says, again, it says a lamb for a household, which means the household means the entire, the major family, the extended family, and then it says a lamb for the house. Sounds like a contradiction. Either it's for the extended family or for the immediate family. A house means a little family, the immediate family. Household means the extended family. Well, which one is it? The Torah seems to be speaking in contradictory terms. You should take a lamb for the first one is base avos, which means the entire the extended family, and then it says a lamb for a house. That's you have in four words in Hebrew, you have a contradiction. But the answer is very simple. The answer is the Paschal lamb must be consumed. So it depends on the size of the house and the household. If it's a small house, let's say two people, just a couple, they can't consume an entire lamb. So then the lamb should be for the extended family. All right? So if, however, it is a large, it could be a family of 20 people, you have a couple and 18 children, they can consume a lamb. So then you can have one lamb for the house. And then in the next verse, the Torah continues and says, and if the, let's say for instance, you don't have an extended family, you have, you just have this couple and they can't consume the lamb. What else can they do? What are the other options? So the option is they can join with their neighbor. Doesn't have to necessarily be with the extended family. You can join with a neighbor, but you must calculate, it says you must calculate on the lamb. What is the calculation about? You must calculate beforehand how many people there are and how much meat there is, and will this lamb be able to be consumed? Okay, so here we have the concept, and this is a very important concept in sacrifices. The concept is that the sacrifice has an objective. Okay, there's an objective to it. There's an objective to the thing. The commandment stems from the object, not simply from the person. It's not like taking the four species, which is completely a commandment of the person doing an action. That's it. Okay, there's no law that the species have to find themselves in the hands of the person. The law is the person has to take the species. But over here, there's a double law. The person must eat, has an obligation to eat that olive size of lamb. That's A. B, the lamb cannot be uneaten. It must be consumed. All right? Now, I'll ask you one question. I think you'll be able to give me the answer. Why is it that a Ben Noach can do just about every commandment, as you know, but cannot eat of the Paschal lamb? Okay? Why not? Is there a logical explanation for this? I'm not talking about philosophy. You know, philosophy is, I don't mean to be degrading, but philosophy is cheap in a sense because, you know, everybody just conjures up their own reasons. I'm talking about here a little more scientific. Is there a logical explanation, a halachic explanation, why the Ben Noach cannot eat from the Paschal lamb? Now, again, you know, most say, well, you see that it's only for Jews. It's not for Ben Noach. Well, that's very funny because the Ben Noach can do practically all the other commandments. Why is he restricted over here? Is there a logical explanation for it? Okay. The answer is very simple. The answer is, if it were just a commandment of doing, the Ben Noach can certainly do it. Like taking the four species, Ben Noach can do it. Sitting in the sukkah, Ben Noach can do it. Put on tefillin, Ben Noach can do it. Where it's an action, the Ben Noach can do it. But over here, there is something different. And that is that the Paschal lamb itself has a certain objective. And the objective is consumption. There, the objective must be consumed only by a person who is in the mandatory system of the 613. It cannot be consumed by a person who has the option of doing the 613, but is only has...
Rabbi, you got less than a minute.
How much?
Less than a minute.
Okay. So, therefore, in the structure, the reason why the Ben Noach cannot do it is because the structure of the mitzvah is based on the objective of the lamb, and the objective of the lamb is the lamb must find itself consumed only by a person who is involved, has the mandatory 613, which is either a born Jew or someone who has converted to to Judaism and has accepted the 613. It's because of the designation of the object. Okay? We'll stop here.